And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
I sat down a few years ago for an Axe Files with then-Senator Al Franken, comedian-turned-politician. Well, a lot has changed since then. He resigned under pressure from Democratic colleagues in the Senate in 2017 over allegations of sexual harassment, an episode and decision that has been the source of controversy to this day. Now he's a politician returned to comedy, touring the country with a highly reviewed stand-up act of political satire. He came to the Institute of Politics last week to perform some of that show, and we had a chance to sit down and talk about the road he's traveled since we last spoke. Here's that conversation. Al Franken, my friend, good to see you.
Good to see you.
Back on the road again with comedy.
That's right. That's right. I'm on the only former U.S. Senator currently on tour, and off tomorrow to Madison, Wisconsin at the Barrymore Theater.
Nice. Very, classy.
It's the Barrymore Theater, where evidently the Barrymores played. And then I go to Detroit. And,
you know, those are the Barrymores of Beloit, right? Not the theatrical family.
That's right.
Yes.
But they funded the Barrymore Theater in Madison.
You say you're the only U.S. senator on tour.
Currently.
Currently, yes. There may be a few more on
Lieberman
tour.
Lieberman was on tour for a while.
There could be a few on tour after November.
He didn't
after
sell
November.
Tickets.
But I was struck by a line that was written about you when you got elected to the Senate.
Okay.
And in the New York Times, and it said, the comedian's ultimate Faustian bargain to get and stay elected, he had to suppress his sense of humor and project an air of utmost seriousness. And I had this vision of your staff before you went out to every event and hearing saying, now, Senator, no jokes, no joking.
Don't be funny.
Yeah, don't be funny.
Don't be funny.
Were these discussions that you had?
Yeah, I mean, I internalized it pretty quickly. Basically, what had happened is that everything I'd ever said or written that could be put through a dehumorizer, which is some Russian technology,
yes,
by the way.
Yes. I think the Chinese have actually perfected on it. But
The Israelis worked on it, too. There's some various versions. Anyway, we got the Russian one, or the Republicans in Minnesota got it. So I would, for example, simple example is in 1998, I think it was, I wrote a magazine article trying to tell parents maybe they should monitor what their kids get online. But I wrote it satirically. So I wrote, my son Joe did a great fourth grade report last week on bestiality. He downloaded a lot of great visual aids, and the kids in the class just loved them. So that became Al Franken.
I think this may have been the impetus behind some legislation in Florida recently.
Well, very different. I will defend myself there. But it was actually on the right side of a thing, which is like, hey, yeah, your
there's
kids.
There's no appetite for satire and humor in that.
Yeah, but this was something that I had done like, you know, I don't know, 10 years previously, of course.
But let me ask you, were there moments when you were in the Senate where you just felt this impulse to break out your Mitch McConnell impression and you said, you know what, maybe not?
You know, it's easy to do in a caucus lunch. I mean, I could be funny in a caucus lunch. I could be funny in the cloakroom. I could be funny on the floor.
You had designated funny areas.
Mainly in the office. Mainly in the office. We just had an incredible amount of fun in my office and got a lot of great work done.
Yes.
But I believe that for a whole period of time, the least turnover of any staff.
Yeah.
Because we were very serious about our work and we did great work, but we just had fun.
The honest to God truth, I mean, we're sitting here at the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago, but everything I've ever been involved in, whether it was campaigns or government or here or the business that I ran, laughter is so important. Having fun is so important.
Oh, my God.
Culture is important.
You know what it's really funny, really important in? comedy.
Yeah, comedy. I imagine it is important, and you're doing it now. You're doing a show that is largely political satire.
I guess so. Yeah, a lot of it is yes, but it's funny. I mean, it's about
Political satire can be funny.
Yes. You know, satire is what closes on Saturday night is what they say, but this is this is funny. And a lot of it is stories about the time in the Senate and, about my former colleagues. And,
he says with a smile, this is a podcast, but there was a Franken-esque grin on his face.
Yeah. There's a whole Ted Cruz section of the show.
And, has he come to see it or?
He hasn't. I don't know. There's a thing I say in the show, and I've said this for years, which is that I probably liked Ted Cruz more than most of my colleagues like Ted Cruz, and I hate Ted Cruz.
Yes.
And it's both of those are true.
Yeah.
And part of it is that Ted kind of considered himself a fan of comedy. So every once in a while, he'd come up to me on a Monday and said, I saw an old repeat of SNL, the Stuart Smalley with other, and that was really funny. I go, you know what? He's not such a bit. Oh, yeah. but every once in a while, I tell the story about he comes up to me and says, I've written, you do this every once in a while, I've written a joke for my stump speech. Can I run it by you? And so I'd go, okay, sure. And this is in 16 when, of course, Hillary's running. And he starts to tell me this joke. And at a certain point, I go, okay, I know the punchline's Hillary's phone. I know that. And the joke goes on and on and on. And finally, Hillary's phone. And I go, well, Ted, your crowd will laugh at that joke. But I have to tell you, I knew the punchline about a third of the way through it. Now, here's my reward for giving him honest feedback. Okay, you tell me a joke.
I wonder, what is the state of political satire and political comedy? And would you have been doing this kind of act 30 years ago? It feels to me like you turn on late night TV, it's a lot more political. And maybe I'm just imagining that. But has the state of comedy changed?
I don't know what you're watching. I mean, it's interesting because I go to clubs and I go watch other comedians who I admire a lot. And it isn't that much political. I mean, obviously, Bill Maher does a show that's about that week's politics and current events. So is political. But there isn't a lot. And it's actually, it depends how you do it. He's carved out an area for himself that the audience knows what they're getting. A number of people have done that.
Yeah, I mean, you've got John Oliver and you've got Samantha Bee and, and
yes,
you've
there's
got
Trevor that. Noah. Those are all sort of...
Off of the Jon Stewart tree.
Those are all the Daily Show tree, which started I did Indecision 92 for Comedy Central, covering the conventions, both the Democratic and Republican conventions, 4 hours a night. So that was called Indecision 92. So that was that predated the Daily Show. But yeah, that's that tree, know, and Politically Incorrect, which became the current real time, is also part of that tree. But if you go to watch stand up, you don't hear a lot of.
I wonder, actually, I could make the opposite argument, which is politics is so crazy making these days that people may be more eager to hear jokes about, I mean, you're a specialized thing because of who you are, but people may lie about life, about day-to-day life.
Oh, that's what people want to hear about.
Yeah.
That's what one of people, and I go to, basically about a little over a year ago, I started saying, I'm going to do stand-up. I started in comedy with my partner, Tom Davis,
yes,
Franklin Davis, and we went to high school together.
Yeah.
And we were big Bob and Ray fans.
Uh-huh.
And so we did Bob and Ray. So when we toured, we did Bob and Ray, which is very different than a guy standing up or a woman standing up doing stand-up.
Yeah.
So I had never really done stand-up, and so I started going to this place with the Comedy Cellar.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm very different than the other performers there. At least half the performers, after they get off the stage, my first line now when I go up there, work out stuff, is, well, so-and-so killed, but no wonder they stole all my material. And their stuff is so dirty. that everyone knows, you know.
It isn't. Now, I don't know if you saw this documentary. We may have talked about it the last time you were on this.
The Aristocrats?
No, about comedian, and it was about Jerry Seinfeld trying to reconstitute his act. And he may have been at the same place, but he'd go and he'd have his yellow legal pad of jokes.
Sure. That's what you
and
do.
And a bunch of them just didn't make it. And people were like booing. And it seemed like a brutal process.
This is so funny. I don't know if I've ever said this publicly. So, okay. So Arlen Specter.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. He loses, right?
Right.
He loses.
Longtime senator from Pennsylvania.
And
Republican turned Democrat.
Right. And because he turned Democrat, when I came in, we were the 60th. And because of that, we were able to pass the ACA. So Arlen loses and the primary, right? Yeah, he loses in the primary. So he comes up to me like the next week, I'm presiding. And he comes up to me, he goes, Al, I was wondering if I could talk to you about comedy. And
so he must have been close to 80 then.
Yes. So I say to him, okay. And then I realize, like, he wants to do comedy. So he said, well, you know, I came in second in the funniest man in Washington contest like 20 years ago or something. So I go, oh, okay. So I go, I said, do you know The Daily Show? And he goes, yeah, I've been on it. I go, well, you know the correspondence, the young correspondence they have on it? He goes, no. So I said, you've been on the show, but you haven't really actually watched it, right? Well, no. Okay, well, they have these young correspondents. It might be funny if they say they have a new comedian correspondent, and it's you, because you're so old. And I go, oh. And I said, well, I'll talk to John about it. So I call up John Stewart, and I run the idea by him, and he has really good instincts. And in about 3 seconds, he goes, no. So I go back to Arlen, and I go, well,
didn't fly.
That didn't fly, but, well, and then we let that lay, and then he leaves the Senate, but then he calls me up, and he had gotten up at a comedy club in Philadelphia, and he kind of told a couple of jokes, and it went a little viral, and so Caroline's in New York wanted him to do a week. So he calls me up, and I go, well, okay, do you have an act? He goes, well, no. And I go, well, you got to get an act. And I said, you know, there's this movie comedian that Seinfeld has done, and you should watch that because process of him putting together an act. So, well, how would I get that? And I tell him how to go on Amazon like that.
These are elements of an act right there.
Well, this is just the truth. So then he calls me about a week later. Well, I got that film from the guy at Seinfeld. I go, yeah. He goes, I don't think he's very funny. And I just said, you know, Arlen, I just wouldn't do, the week of Caroline's.
And did he?
No, I don't think he did.
Yeah.
I don't think he did.
So speaking of John Stewart,
that's
and
a
looking
story
at,
you've never, not going to hear anywhere else.
Speaking of John Stewart and looking at you, short Jewish comedians are all the rage right now because you got this guy, Zelensky, who moved,
5'6".
We
all know each other's height.
I don't know how to interpret all that, but you know, he went from playing a president in a sitcom, which is very good, by the way, Servant of the People.
Yeah, yeah.
It's on Netflix. And he now becomes president.
Yes.
And now he's Churchill.
Yes.
Is that like a natural progression for comedians?
I thought so. I thought so. I think we've talked a little bit about this, which is when you are a performer, and he's also obviously a writer.
Yes.
But when you're a performer, you pick up certain skills, right? And I noticed this like when I was in the Senate, that none of my colleagues had been actual performers in that sense. And I was on Judiciary, and many had been prosecutors, but I think they were prosecutors like U.S. attorney and stuff like that, not people in kind of like courtroom prosecutors. And when you're a performer, you learn stuff. You learn how to present stuff, and you learn how to do it more powerfully, or you certainly, if you're a comedian, be funny, but to be more effective. And he is, he's a
great communicator.
He's a great communicator.
Last week, I had Mike McFaul on my podcast. You may know him, the former ambassador to Russia under Obama. And Mike's very close to Zelensky. And he told some stories about his interactions with Zelensky that really, really spoke to a very keen sense of timing and communication and the moment. And you could see it in his speeches too. You know, he spoke to Congress and invoked American history, and he spoke to the Knesset and he invoked the Holocaust, and he's really, really, and he throws off good lines.
Churchill to the parliament.
Yes, really, really good. So you're back in show business, but I know that wasn't your plan.
Right, no.
You know, we knew each other when you were in the Senate.
Yep.
You kicked my ass once at a caucus.
We met cute. In movies, you know what that term is?
Yes, cute. You meet, you have this kind of friction, and then you fall in love.
That's right.
Okay. Yeah, I get that.
That's usually usually a man and a woman, and in a movie.
Yes.
And
is like a bromance kind of.
Yeah. Yes. So you meet cute, and we met cute.
Yes. I didn't think it was that cute at the time.
But. Well, in terms, meeting cute means not. It isn't cute. It was I yelled at you.
Yeah, which was my role. You know, when you're in the White House, you get sent down to the Hill or up to the Hill. It was over the ACA. It's just a long story, and I got a lot to cover.
Okay.
But let me just say that being a White House aide and being sent up to the Hill is a form of human sacrifice. Generally, you go when the caucus is pissed, and you go, and your job is to take it. Okay. At least it was. My job was.
Okay, this is just very quickly. Scott Brown wins.
Yeah,
in Massachusetts.
Okay, you're going to tell the story, aren't you?
Very quickly, very quickly. We now only have 59. It means that the House has to pass the ACA as we wrote it. They don't want to do it. We don't know what's happening. We have this retreat where you're in front of all the Democrats, and two people talked before you, Begala and Tim Kaine.
I think the president was there in the morning.
He was there with cameras, so I'm sure he couldn't tell us what was going on because he had cameras there.
You wanted to know what the plan was to get the House to embrace
the
bill that the Senate had passed, because you'd lost your 60. You couldn't pass another
bill. I wanted to know what the plan was to get the ACA passed.
Yes.
And for whatever reason, you couldn't say it, right?
Well, I mean, it wasn't that mysterious.
Well,
you were speaking about show business. You were a little theatrical, and you were like, "I'm doing a slow burn over here. I'm livid."
I was.
People come here. No one's telling us what the plan is. And the fact was, we were trying to one by one get members of the House to come over and support the bill, and it wasn't easy, and it had to be done sort of subterranean. And you said to me, why isn't the president telling the Speaker of the House to go and to pass that bill?
And
I said
votes.
To you, and yeah. I said to you, look, if you have a list of 218 members of the House who are willing to support it, you ought to walk across the rotunda and give it to the Speaker, because she doesn't have that list. But it was memorable.
Right, and you thought that I was actually acting. Or trying to act, but I wasn't. I was really pissed. So okay, enough of that.
Well, I was relieved that you were actually pissed, because if you actually were acting, it wasn't very good acting. But if you were really pissed, it was good.
My contention is, since I really was pissed, it wasn't acting.
Okay.
And therefore, if it had been acting, it would have been very good acting.
All right.
Well, we'll leave it there.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show.
Listen, I want to run through, because I would be remiss if I didn't, the circumstances of you leaving the Senate. And I just want to kind of set the context, okay?
Sure.
For it, because you don't talk that much about it. I understand that's not topic A on your list of things to
Yep.
Talk about for a whole range of reasons, but you resigned abruptly from the Senate in 2017.
Right.
And it was over charges of sexual harassment. The main one was leveled by someone, a former model and a broadcaster who was part of your troop when you were doing USO tours. You were in Afghanistan together.
Well, we did Kuwait, Afghanistan, and Iraq, which I had done. This was the Sergeant Major of the Army's Christmas tour, which this was
the old Bob Hope tour.
It was basically a Bob Hope tour, and basically I designed it like a Bob Hope tour. And what
you were the featured player?
Yeah, I was sort of the MC, and I had a co-MC who was, you know, and he would have, you know, Raquel Welch or Joey Heatherton or something like that, and Bob Hope's character was always the leering kind of guy. And so we would do this kind of old-fashioned show. We had Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders and who I was.
Because these were for troops in forward places often.
Yeah, well, there were forward operating bases, but then there were larger bases mm-hmm. too. So we were basically out for almost 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So we did Kuwait first and then we did Iraq.
We don't have to go through all the details, the essence of it was, the main thing was that she released a photo that was 11 years old that had been circulated to everybody who had been on the tour.
Yeah.
And it was of you kind of doing this leering sort of setup thing where she had fallen asleep on the plane.
I get on the plane. The photographer says, "I'll take a picture." Without thinking, I just go, "Okay." And this is the comedy of being a jerk. Mm-hmm. And we had been out. We'd been in war zones. We had gone to hospitals. We had seen guys who were going to die. We had been to a memorial. It was very dark humor, and we were also entertaining the troops, and they loved the damn show.
Mm-hmm.
And we were, I was very proud of what we were doing. And part of it was, and so I just took that picture that second.
It was like a pretending to fondle her breasts as she slept. With a full leering look on your face.
Yes.
You didn't touch her. She was wearing body armor, but tasteless nonetheless. You would, in retrospect, taking it out of context, if you were someone looking at that picture.
Well, yes, that's what happened. And it was like right after, it was like a week or two after Harvey Weinstein's thing. And it was just a certain moment.
And some other women came and said, well, he was aggressive with us on picture lines, on photo lines that you as a celebrity.
Yeah. And these are, I'd gone 66 years without anyone saying anything like that.
Yeah.
And then suddenly this thing hits and I know what it was and it wasn't what, I've been in photo lines and I've said that if I made anyone feel uncomfortable, when you take pictures, especially when you're in show business and something like that, people try to get as intimate as possible.
But the point is, this was a particular moment in time.
It was.
All of this surfaced at the height of this Me Too moment, as you said, when really horrendous charges of sexual assault were surfacing relative to celebrities, mm-hmm. to journalists, to executives. Yes, Harvey Weinstein was the most prominent example of this. You had sponsored legislation in the Senate to address issues of sexual harassment. I mean, this was an issue that you had worked on.
My second bill was on contractors. There was a woman, Jamie Lee Jones, who had claimed she had been raped by KBR employees. She worked for KBR, and I think it was in Iraq. And she had signed an employment contract that had mandatory arbitration agreement in it. So I did a bill saying that there can't be mandatory arbitration in employment contracts when it comes to sexual harassment or sexual assault. And that was my second bill. And I got that passed.
So you did these things and
I did a number of other bills.
Now you're being pictured on the screen
mm-hmm.
with Harvey Weinstein and I don't know who else was, there are other things surfaced over
Lauer
time. Matt Lauer, ultimately Charlie Rose. There were, mm-hmm. First of all, what were you thinking when you saw that picture that you took in Afghanistan 11 years earlier?
Mm-hmm. Well, I knew the context of the time, and I went, oh my God. That's what I thought. Mm-hmm. I went, oh my God. And I know, and then also I immediately kind of went a little bit in the shock, and she was accusing me of stuff that, you know, wasn't true. And,
she accused you of stealing kisses at in a rehearsal for the skit.
Yeah, more than stealing. I mean, anyway, Jane Mayer talks about
This, and I suggest people read Jane Mayer, really a fine, one of the great investigative reporters in the country, did a very long takeout. I think the most exhaustive one on this whole episode.
The only one.
In the New Yorker. And I suggest people who are interested find it. So now you're...
So now I'm going like, oh my God. And my team says, well, what if there are other... that it's that day. What if there are other allegations? I go, oh, there aren't going to be. Now, remember, I had... you know, I worked at SNL for 15 seasons with a lot of women. I mean, I've just, nothing like this had ever happened. So then these other allegations happen. And I said, well, okay, look, it's never my intention to make a woman feel uncomfortable. And if I did, I apologize. And to me, that has been logged as he admitted it or something like that. And okay, well, I would ask people to read Jane.
But here's the conundrum, and this is the challenge of our times. For time immemorial, women who made these allegations were not taken seriously.
Right.
I mean, that's one of the reasons you wrote the bills you wrote, and they deserve to be taken seriously.
Absolutely.
It was horrendous that they weren't. On the other hand, it's also true that any allegation both should be taken seriously, but they should also warrant a hearing, a fair hearing.
Yes.
And
that's what I asked for. I asked for, you know, I said right away, I asked for an ethics investigation, the ethics process. The ethics process, you know, Gene Shaheen, Brian Schatz, who else was on the Democratic side, and then three on the Republican side, to do an ethics hearing and investigation. And that's what I asked for. And I thought, okay, that's the right way to handle this. And my colleagues,
Well, there was another thing going on right there.
Yes,
I mean, this was like a perfect storm.
Because
it was the peak of all the pent up, I think,
righteousness
indignation over generations of
millennium
of these kinds of charges being leveled but ignored. Plus, you had a political storm going on, which was there was a special election in Alabama for the Senate. Democrats had a rare opportunity to get that seat because the Republican nominee was accused of some really dramatic, assaulting underage women and so on. But the dilemma for Democrats, as they saw it, was, well, how can we defend Franken and attack that guy? That this would make us less effective. So there was a very quick move to get you to leave.
Yep. And so I had a Democratic governor.
Yes. Yeah, so, yes, had you had a Republican governor, there would have been a less of a...
They wouldn't have done that.
Yeah. It's interesting. You said in the Jane Mayer piece that you regretted resigning. And so how much do you feel culpable? And how much do you feel like that was a big mistake? That I love, because I know how much you love that job, and I want to talk to you about the Senate in a second.
But. You know, one of the things about trauma, and this was a traumatic experience to me, partly because it was so public, partly because I lost this job that meant so much to me because I could do so much with it. And also, when you're a politician, what you're judged by is how effective you are, and resigning isn't very effective. So part of it is I go in circles all the time and it drives me nuts. And part of it is could I have stayed there? And the pressure that was put on me was tremendous. And I felt like my staff was being kind of, I didn't know what was going to happen to them. I didn't know. And
the leader himself, Senator Schumer,
he was not
helpful. So you left.
Yep.
And the fact is, you and I weren't very close, but we talked a lot after that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very, very clear to me, and you were very clear, that this was trying. You know, you and I both would agree that women who go through the experience of sexual harassment, sexual assault, that is a traumatic experience.
Absolutely.
For them. And the ways in which they are victimized, those have to be honored and recognized.
There's so much trauma. I mean, think about people during this pandemic losing family.
Yeah.
Or being isolated in the way they were, or people in Ukraine right now.
Yes.
I mean, so comparing trauma is probably not a productive thing.
But it's important. But it's
I'm not saying you are. I don't want to do that.
All I'm saying is that I know you don't want to dismiss that, but I want to really probe your own experience after this, because this happened lightning fast.
Yep.
And all of a sudden your life is turned upside down. And tell me what you went through. Tell me, you know, I talk a lot about mental health and mental illness on this show because of personal experiences that I've had in my own family.
Mm-hmm.
And because I think it's important that we talk about it because it's part of the human condition.
Yeah.
But you went through serious, serious depression.
Yeah, I did. And it was very traumatic experience. And part of it is that it stays in your body.
How did it manifest itself?
Well, a lot of it goes through where some juices flow that are not helpful juices, you know? And so it's a physical phenomenon. And then it also affects your brain. And so that you start going to the same place over and over again and can't stop. These are, you know, the body keeps the score is the book by Vander Kolk about this, and other books as well. There's been a lot of research on this and on veterans, you know. And so it's very, very much in your body and very physical. And it's there. And I have a great family, and I have friends, really good friends. But I had friends who were really incredibly well-meaning who would go like, well, just get over it. Mm-hmm. You know, just like, okay, it's been a month. you know, get over it. And I go like, okay,
I think that is actually the core of this, which is you can't. If you're mired in depression, you're in a long, dark tunnel, and it's not exactly clear where the light is.
Yeah, and it really, like, literally is something you flash back to, and something you, I mean, I would wake up every morning, that's where I would be. You start thinking in circles, which does you absolutely no good, and you know that. Your therapist says, you know, that doesn't do you any good, but if you have a good therapist, they're also saying you can't help it.
So thinking in circles, you know, when you say thinking in circles, like going back to everything that happened, thinking about what you could have done, what you should have done.
Yeah, what I could have, should have, would have.
Mm-hmm.
Could have, should have, would have is not helpful.
Yeah, one of your predecessors as senator from Minnesota, Hubert Humphrey, one said the two biggest clubs in the world are the woulda club and the shoulda club, and neither are worth belonging to.
Mm-hmm.
But but when you're depressed,
really?
It's, yes.
I don't remember that.
I'm giving you a little Minnesota stuff.
No, thank you. Oh, yeah. Okay.
So how did you dig out? And how long did it take for you to dig out?
Well,
you've been, by the way, in the spotlight since you were a young man. I mean, you had been a public person.
Yeah, and basically on an arc up.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, I've had some real downs. I made movies that completely failed and stuff like that. But yeah, this was just a unique experience in my life. I had had a very fortunate life up to then in many, many ways, and almost always. And this was just a blow. And you know, and again, I just want everyone to understand who's listening that I know that I don't want to compare my trauma to anybody else's or, you know.
But what advice would you give people who are going through trauma, acknowledging that everybody's story is different, but there are certain common elements of depression that everybody feels. And I think part of it is maybe a feeling that this is unique to you, that this is something that, you know, no one would understand because it's unique.
It does help to read. Mm-hmm. And it helps to get pointed in the right direction by someone who knows stuff. And I have a therapist. I went through a few therapists till I found one that I really felt was who I've been with a few years now, who I felt did me some good. I had one that would do a lot of like, and how do you feel now?
Mm-hmm.
And I go, okay, well, I'm a little confused. And how do you feel now? I'm still confused. And how do you feel now? I'm kind of getting angry. How do you feel now? Angrier, you know, and she didn't last long.
Yeah.
But so you have to find someone who fits. She might've been perfect for someone who says, oh, I feel this. I mean, who maybe was more in touch with their feelings at the time. So
finding the right person is one.
That's it. Also, it really does help to have supportive family and friends. I mean, mm-hmm. And so, you know, I have four grandchildren and, you know, there's nothing like grandkids to go get out of it, you know? And I have an 8-year-old who's going to be 9 next month. And I have a 5-year-old who's his sister. Then I have a 6-year-old boy on the other side and a 3-year-old girl. And they're all very different and they all love me.
Mm-hmm.
And cuddling is amazing.
Yeah.
Touch means so much. Yeah. And you know who said that to me? Paul Wellstone.
Is that right? Your mentor?
Well.
Friend.
My friend. I think when you say someone's my mentor, you're taking too much credit mm-hmm. for like, you know. Yeah,
no, I think that's fair.
Yeah.
But he was a great progressive senator
I'll tell you
from
the context.
Minnesota.
I'll tell you the context. This is just a few weeks before he died. I did a fundraiser for him.
He died in a plane crash. I think most people remember.
Yeah, yes, of course. So my mom was in a nursing home and had dementia. And
In Minnesota.
So I see him at this event, get there early. He said, how's your mom? And I said, well, you know, it's hard because sometimes I get there and I really can't even have a conversation. I can't talk to her. And he goes, you know, touch means so much. Mm. And that's Paul, right? Mm-hmm. And of course, after that event, I went to, she was at this this great place and went out to this beautiful garden and she was not in great shape, but I hugged her. And it did make a difference, at least to me.
Yeah.
And, but I think to her, and that was Paul. And that actually, Paul was the reason I ran for the Senate.
Mm-hmm. No, I remember.
Yeah.
You know, one thing I would say about, I have grandchildren now too. I was visiting with a friend who was quite ill this week and I left that meeting and I was really despairing because he obviously was in very bad shape. And I saw a message on my phone from my 7-year-old granddaughter and I called her back and she was filled with excitement, wanting to tell me about how she had studied the Mayans at school that day and how exciting it was. And, you know, she filled me in on the rest of her day and it was a tonic. But I'll tell you this, you know, my dad, and I've talked about this very often, probably more often than I should here because it's something that I think about a lot. But my dad, I lost him to suicide. And when you say family is important, one of my great regrets is that he didn't feel like he could burden
mm-hmm.
us.
Yeah.
With that. So
you don't really feel like burdening your family with that.
Yeah.
You know, you don't say, keep me away from the subway platform, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't want to worry them.
But I think the point I'm making is it's really important to not talk to people.
Yeah. And the people around you, you know, it's funny because you're talking about your 7-year-old talking about what, you know, you said that she texted you. Because what I get from my 8-year-old grandson is just a poop emoji. That's maybe yes. what I get.
Well, boys mature at a different rate, let me say.
That's all I could think of. And that cheers me up. I go, okay.
Yeah, that's something. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files.
And now, back to the show.
You are a very engaged senator.
Yep.
Do you slip over to C-SPAN to watch what your colleagues are doing? And when you watch what's going on in the Senate, do you find yourself sort of shaking your fist at the screen saying, why don't they do this?
Yep.
Why aren't they doing that?
Yeah. You know, I was watching the Jackson hearings, and I felt like...
And you were on the Judiciary.
I was on Judiciary, and I felt like I was not a lawyer, but I played one in a sketch. And but
that was enough to get on the committee, huh?
When I got on the committee, I didn't ask for Judiciary. No one wanted to be on it for some reason, and Harry just gave that. He gave
Harry
me,
Reid. Yeah.
By the way, I want to tell just a Harry or two story, but we can save it for later. Friggin' great guy, but. Yeah, I was watching that, and I was going like, you know, come on, answer these Republicans, because they were being entirely unfair to her, and no one was, you know, for example, Hawley had put out some stuff that was a guy from National Review, a conservative, has said that it bordered on demagoguery, and part of what he had done is she had been, I think this is when she was with the Sentencing Commission. Somebody had testified that people who have this material,
child pornography
aren't necessarily pedophiles. And so she replies in this hearing something like, so people have this material aren't necessarily pedophiles, ? And he just says, you said in this hearing, people have this material aren't necessarily pedophiles. And this had already been indicated before in an article before the hearing that he was taking a question, basically repeating back what somebody had said in testimony to her and saying that that's what she was asserting. And so no one went like, Senator Hawley, that is entirely unfair. Mm-hmm. What are you doing here? And you know it.
And you feel you would have if you were sitting.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. You know, just as an aside, when I was doing the research for the McFaul thing, you know, he became a target of Putin.
Of Putin's, yeah.
And one of the things they circulated, I think, had to do with him and pedophilia. And this has become a sort of a meme of the kind of populist right all over the world, disinformation about that.
That Putin was really on the forefront of a lot of disinformation, of just the whole idea of sending out disinformation and letting it percolate up.
But this particular theme and you know, everyone on the Republican side,
grooming running, and all yeah, this yeah, bullshit.
That stuff is, you know, really QAnon stuff, and it is really striking how this now has become sort of such a pronounced meme. So you get aggravated when you hear that. Does that make it harder thinking about I should have been there?
Yeah. Yeah. Doesn't take much to let me go like, damn it.
Yeah.
You know, damn it. And, you know, right now there's other parts of it that go like, oh my God, this is worse than when I was there. You know, when I first got there in 2009, I was on the floor, like my first day, I think, and with a few of the older senators, veterans, and they said, oh, it's the worst it's ever been. And then Carl Levin, who was great, Carl says, well, actually, it's been worse. And I said, oh, really, when? He says, 1854.
Yeah. And that culminated in a civil war.
And I said, you're talking about Charles Sumner getting caned on the floor? Yes. Yeah. I said, well, you know, that was, yes. I said, that was the Civil War. Yes. I go, okay. But since...
it actually does seem like it's worse. And I think what you're going to see in this midterm, that you're going to see a lot of people lose who are sort of glue people who, you know, who are people who actually can work.
Hope not, boy.
But I mean, I think that's the
who are you thinking?
Well, I'm just talking about, I'm not talking about the Senate now. I know you're a senator, so you don't actually think about the House. Oh,
dare I say the House?
But I'm talking about the House. But I do think, depending on how high the tide is, I think everyone in a close, like in Arizona, in Georgia, in Nevada, all of them are in danger. But this raises a point, which is in 2000.
I think there's many a slip twixt cup and lip for the Republicans, and I think a lot of stuff can happen between now and then, including the June 6th. In June, there'll be the January 6th hearings.
Yes.
And then there'll also be the Supreme Court will come out. They'll get rid of Roe.
Yeah, which will presumably galvanize people.
Yeah, so I think there's some mileage to go.
And it does matter. Candidates do matter depending on the size of the tide. I mean, if the tide is, 1980, you and I are both old enough to remember, there are some people who got elected who are complete knuckleheads, and they defeated some of the giants in the history of the U.S. Senate, but the Reagan wave was such that they were able to get elected.
I don't remember which was worse. 84 was as bad, or by then they had all been cleaned out.
No, I think that was the year that you lost Church, McGovern, a whole bunch of really stellar people in the Senate. On both sides, by the way, Javits lost that year
in a primary. Church and McGovern, we're talking Idaho and South Dakota, and you're seeing a trend.
Let me ask you about this, because in 2014, you got reelected, and you got reelected by 10 points.
Yeah.
In a state that has a large rural population.
Yep.
And Democrats lost, I think, 9 seats in the Senate that year. Am I right about that?
I think something like that.
Yeah. All right. So you've got the secret sauce. What is your advice to Democrats now? And is there it looks as if little by little, rural states are becoming inaccessible to Democrats. You look at 2024, Al, and Tester in Montana is up, Sherrod Brown in Ohio, and of course Manchin, who now is actually pretty popular because Republicans like him in West Virginia.
Oh yeah, Manchin is. I'm not worried about Joe.
I'm
worried whether he stays a Democrat, but I think he will. Tester seems to pull these out. Sherrod seems to do really well in the state.
All right, that's
let me talk about rural Minnesota. The trend has been, part of it is just where people are getting their information. It's where people are being separated. People are living in blue people live in bluer areas, and red people live in redder areas. We know that there is what media they consume. But one of the things is it makes a difference if you're a candidate. One of the things I loved about running for the Senate the first time and being a senator and campaigning the second time and still being a senator is that you meet everybody. You know, people ask me like, oh, going on tour, what are you hearing? Are you hearing a lot of, what are people saying? I go, I don't know. People come to see me or people like me. I don't know. When I was in Minnesota, I would go everywhere in Minnesota and I would talk to, and you find out that people are pretty great. And like, oh, you know what drove me nuts is when Cruz went to Cancun. And when he went to Cancun, and of course he lied about it and came back. And then I remember Ben Shapiro said like, well, there's nothing he could do anyway.
This was during the ice storms in Texas.
Yeah. And I went, no, during a disaster, you can do an awful lot. And one of the things you do is that you're one of only 2 statewide elected federal officials. And you have a staff, and they're in touch with FEMA. And you can, if you see like a water purification plant that they don't have electricity, you can get a diesel generator to them and get clean water for people. You also can go and tell people, okay, it's a federal disaster. Keep records of what you've lost, which gives them hope. But you also learn how fucking great people are. And I've been to floods where people are giving people housing, where churches are serving meals. And I don't know if they're Republicans or Democrats. I just don't know.
No, it's such an important
point. I remember this one couple. This is south of Duluth, terrible flood. They lost their home, foundation broke. And it was 96 that day. And he's like in these weird little shorts and he's fat and sweaty. And they went, well, we were thinking of moving to Missouri now because we have family there. But, these teenagers, they took all our stuff to the dumpster. They spent the whole weekend doing that. And we're going to stay here because this is our community.
Mm-hmm.
You learn how great people are.
Mm-hmm.
Well, can feel that.
That's one of the tragedies of our time, the dehumanization. We yield to caricatures. And if you can penetrate that, you find out that we have a common humanity.
Humor makes a difference too. Like the first time I met, there's this thing called Farm Fest in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. So the first time I did Farm Fest, so I'm from St. Louis Park, which yes. is the Jewish suburb of Minneapolis.
Yes.
So you can imagine how much I knew about farming growing up.
Yes.
So I go to this thing, Farm Fest, is every year they have it in southwestern Minnesota, and all these farmers, but also people. One out of six jobs in Minnesota is tied to ag.
Did you say, where do you grow pickles?
Well, I know they're cucumbers and you brine them. I yes, do sir. Know that. But anyway, okay. I knew enough of that. But anyway, so you speak under this tent with 300 farmers and other people. So at one point I just go, you know, I grew up in St. Louis Park, and everybody in Minnesota knows what St. Louis Park is. I said, and as you can imagine, growing up, I knew nothing about farming. In fact, when I was 8 years old, if you had asked me where food comes from, guess what I would have said? In a few months, grocery store. And I said, no, I would have said the farm, because I wasn't a complete idiot. The whole place burst into laughter. They liked me. Mm-hmm. And because yeah. they're saying, like, how can someone not know food comes from a farm, mm-hmm. really? Mm-hmm. You know, this is what I was saying. And so, you know, obviously I was endorsed by the Farmers Union. But the Farm Bureau and the Farm Bureau endorsed Coleman. But the second time out, when I won by 10 points, the Farm Bureau didn't endorse anybody.
Yeah, which is a win.
Because I knew their issues. Mm-hmm. And I disagree with them on some things, but they knew me.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no reason that you can't have the people in your state know you.
No one can listen to this and not divine how much you enjoyed this. Now, when you're on the road and you ignite, you know, people who show up at your shows, they show up at your shows because they like you.
Mm-hmm.
How often do people say, you really ought to come back? You really ought to be in politics again?
Well, till recently, I've had this thing where I draw a map of the U.S. and answer questions. But I
you draw the map while you're answering questions.
I'm the only person in America who can do that. Yeah. Anyway, so people would fill out these questions on cards, and half of them are you going to run again? Are you going to run again? Are you going to run again?
And what do you say?
I don't answer those questions.
Oh, I see. I see. Well, your bad fortune is that you're sitting here with me now, and okay. I'm asking you the question. Do you think you can? Mm-hmm. Do you think you should? Mm-hmm. Do you think you might?
Ken should, might.
Yes. Yeah, you can draw a map. Down. You can certainly remember these three words.
No, I have to write them down. Yeah. Ken. Should, might.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Can I run again? I don't know. Should I? I don't know. Might I? No. Okay. Can I run again? I don't know. But I think I could. It depends what we're talking about. Should I? You know, some people ask me, like, should, you know, 24, I could run in New York in 24. I'm not going to do that. You know, we're going to have to be using so many resources to reelect President Biden or whoever we're running that. I hope it's Biden. And we're just going to, all these races are going to be up. We can't spare those resources, but maybe somewhere else. Might I do it? I'm keeping it open. Can I do it? I wouldn't do it if I didn't think I could. The reason I would want to do it is I love being able to get things done and accomplish things for people. And I did a lot of that. And I thought I was good at it.
And how would you react to the weaponization of what happened to you? And you would get a lot of very hostile questions and some very legitimate questions about the whole last episode of your political career and how it ended.
Well, I'd have to answer them. And, you know, that's, you know, the question is, to what extent would that be a terrible experience for mm-hmm. my family?
Right.
And for my grandchildren?
Right.
That's something that weighs on me.
Yes.
And weighs on my kids. So I think by now, all the time, I have people coming up to me that are very supportive. Of course, people that aren't probably don't come up to you,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's very nice of them. But my sense of this is maybe skewed a little bit, but my sense is that most people think that I got a bad deal.
Before we go, I do want to, Harry Reid passed away.
Oh, God, love Harry.
Former majority leader, Democratic leader in the Senate, really a one of a kind. You said you wanted to tell us stories about him. So just share your favorite story about Harry Reid.
Well, Harry had a very dry sense of humor, but a great sense of humor. I just wanted to tell this one. So after State of the Union address, we're going from the House chamber back to the Senate, and we're walking through Statuary Hall, and there's this red carpet down the middle of it, and on either side are gaggles, huge gaggles of press, and there's this just din in bouncing off the ceilings and
The marble
walls, and all that. So no one can hear anything anybody's saying unless you're right next to them. So I'm walking with Harry, and I turn to Harry and I go, "Harry, talk to me like I'm important." And Harry, without skipping a beat, just turns to me and goes, "That would be impossible." And that was Harry. Was Harry. And Harry would, like, very often in caucus lunches, Harry would be the only person who would laugh at my joke. And so once,
so that's why you loved him, huh?
Well, that's, yes, actually, anybody who laughs at my stuff, I love him. So one day, like, Bernie, it was ranking on budget, and so he's reporting what the Republicans passed out of the budget committee, and it went, and this thing, they cut food stamps. And so Bernie goes, "What kind of religion wants to cut food stamps?" And I just say, "Southern Baptist." And Harry was the only one who laughed. I thought, that's a great joke. Thank you, Harry.
Well, maybe it's better that you're back on the road again, huh?
Well, you know, so a lot of my colleagues had really good senses of humor, but every once in a while, Harry was the only one really tuned into it.
Well, Al, it's good to see you. I'm glad to see you out and about and back on the road.
Well, it's good to see you. Thanks for inviting me. Thanks for your friendship. You know, we met cute. And the whole point about meeting cute is that then you have a bromance afterwards.
Yeah.
And I really am so grateful for your friendship.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, brought to you by the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio. The executive producer of the show is Allison Siegel. The show is also produced by Miriam Finder Annenberg, Jeff Fox, and Hannah Grace McDonald. And special thanks to our partners at CNN, including Rafina Ahmad, Courtney Koop, Ashley Lusk, and Megan Marcus. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.